I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, decades of secret government projects so weird that we can't help but be glad they failed. We'll spend this hour with historian Vince Houghton. He's the curator at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and over the years, he's collected story after story of bizarre plots that somebody thought might advance national security, from loading bats with explosives and releasing them over enemy territory, to building an aircraft carrier out of ice, to breaking up a hurricane by dropping nuclear weapons into the eye. We'll talk about how far these schemes got before somebody asked, "What were you thinking?" and about what they demonstrate about the nature of human innovation. Our conversation starts after a short break. It would be hard to overstate how devastated Americans were when the Soviets managed to launch an artificial satellite before we did. Sputnik looked to Americans like a triumph over U.S. innovation and also an implied threat, with the Soviets put weapons into orbit next. What was needed was a show of brute American strength and technological superiority that would get the whole world's attention. So the Air Force asked a team of scientists, a team that included a grad student named Carl Sagan, to game out what might happen if the United States were to detonate a nuclear weapon on the moon. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That didn't happen, of course. We ultimately stunned the world by putting humans on the moon. But the mere fact that scientists and military leaders gave serious consideration to such a bizarre plot raises a fascinating question. What else almost happened in the name of national security or intelligence? Vince Houghton has been asking that exact question for years. He is historian and curator at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and he's just published a new book full of the profoundly weird true stories he's collected. It's called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you say at the outset this book is about desperation and also about innovation. Does desperation just basically eliminate the filters we place on ideas?
I think it's a really great way of putting it. The idea is during normal times, when we're not necessarily desperate, we don't have a true existential threat to our existence, like we did in World War II or in the Cold War, we may not allow ourselves to go down these paths. We may stop short and say, no, I have certain things and lines I'm willing not to cross. But when nothing else works, when you've tried every other possibility, and you truly face a threat to your existence, like we did when the Soviets had 65,000 nuclear warheads pointed at us in the 1980s, or when the Nazis were marching across Europe and the Imperial Japanese across the Pacific, you start saying, you know what? Nothing's off the table, right? No holds barred. We're going to do anything and everything we possibly can to find a way to mitigate that existential threat. And that's really what this book is about.
So a lot of thought is put into naming these projects, right? So I want to start with one that sounds ridiculous, even based on its code name, Operation Acoustic Kitty. How did scientists at the CIA try to develop spy cats?
Yeah, and that's it shows that there's someone at CIA has a sense of humor, because that's the official title for the project. This stemmed from a CIA officer, probably, and there's some urban legend behind this, but in Istanbul, Turkey, and if you've ever been to Istanbul, there's stray cats everywhere. And he noticed that while he was watching the Soviet embassy, that stray cats could just wander in and out at will, into the Soviet embassy, into the compound, and even jump up and sit on the laps of Soviet military personnel or probably spies sitting on benches in the courtyard having conversations, and said, wow, all right, if we could get a covert listening device on that cat, or in this case, inside that cat, then we would have the perfect way to listen in what the Soviets are doing. So they did just that. They surgically implanted a covert listening device inside a common house cat, put the power pack inside the abdomen, wired the microphone up into its ear canal, that it uses ears as filters for the sound, wrapped the antenna down through its tail, and then had the perfect robo-kitty. Now, the problem, of course, is you got to train the cat to do your operation, your secret mission. And anyone who's been around cats for 30 seconds knows that that's a very difficult prospect. And the more realistic version of the story says that the training was the thing they could not overcome, right? It was the rock and the hard place together, where it's just, you know, the cats would just not listen, would not be trained. There's another version of the story that I'm very kind of open about. I don't know the right answer in the book about how it actually did get trained through another program called MKUltra, which some listeners may be familiar with. It was the CIA mind control program usually people associate MKUltra with the hallucinogenics, with right. LSD, but MKUltra was up to 150 different programs. And some of them dealt with electronic brain stimulation of animals. And the story goes that they went back in surgically and rewired the cat's brain to overcome that natural instinct to disobey, the natural instinct to go get food when it's hungry, the natural instinct to kind of lick itself when it felt it was dirty.
I think everybody wants a cat like that.
Right, exactly. Like, so the perfect robo cat, like basically turn the cat into a dog without changing it physically. And then they tested it in a real world situation. And that's where the kind of tragedy comes into play, where the story is that they brought it to Northwest DC, not too far from where we are right now. And there's two men sitting on a park bench. They weren't Soviet spies. They were just random guys. They wanted to test this. And the CIA guys or techs were in some spy van. You know, maybe it was a black, dark black van, or it could have been had Bob's landscaping on the side of it, or like Ethel's flowers, some secret spy van. Inside all the equipment and all the technology that from the 1960s.
We can all picture it, right?
Oscilloscopes and little knobs and switches. And put the cat down on the street and hit the important knobs, and the cat made a perfect beeline for the two guys sitting on the bench. And I like to, there's no evidence of this, there's no anything, but I like to kind of put myself in their shoes. That's mm-hmm. what this book is all about. And so I kind of think about what those guys were thinking at that moment. Like, they had accomplished the impossible. They had trained a cat to be a covert listening device. They were thinking about, I'm going to get a raise, I'm going to get a promotion, I'm going to buy that motorcycle so the spy guys will think I'm cool. But they weren't paying attention to traffic when they sent Acoustic Kitty on her first mission. And so halfway across the street, our feline hero got run over by a DC cab and sat there smushed on the street. And that's problematic for a lot of reasons. One is we'd spent millions of dollars on this program. But the bigger issue, this wasn't just your average everyday roadkill. This was a smoking, sparking roadkill, a CIA technology in the middle of the street. So those poor guys, no promotions, no raises, no motorcycles. They had to go scrape Acoustic Kitty off Connecticut Avenue before the Soviets got word of what they're doing, or worse yet, before the Washington Post found out what was happening.
The irony of that is that beforehand, they actually did, you found evidence that the CIA actually worked pretty hard not to harm the cat. I mean, you know, giving it unnecessary surgery is arguably harmful, but they tried not to allow the test cats to suffer. That was not the case when we thought about using bats.
Well, I'm not sure how much they would have suffered. There'd just been a lot of dead bats. Yeah. I mean, this would have been something where we were willing, certainly in the Second World War, to kill, if not tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of bats. And this was an idea that, to this day, I think maybe makes the most sense operationally of all the different stories in this book. It may have worked. The idea came from a dentist, of all people, who was coming back from vacation. When he heard on the radio, like so many others did on December 7th, 1941, that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. And he had been vacationing in the southwest United States, where there are just bat caves all over the place. And he had just kind of had this epiphany at that moment and said, well, we know that bats, from our basic understanding, will, during the daytime, try to find a cool, dry, and dark place to hide out, to sleep, to hibernate until it's dark and they can fly around. So if we drop them over Japan, they'll naturally find ways to find nooks and crannies and attics and eavesments of Japanese houses and buildings to find that cool, dry, dark place. If we can attach an incendiary device to these bats, that could cause some damage, because at the time in the 1940s, I mean, Tokyo right now is a major metropolitan city
right.
made up of glass and steel buildings. At the time, though, most of Japan was made up of wood and even sometimes paper buildings and houses. So bats plus bombs plus wood and paper houses, you could burn Japan to the ground. And this is an idea that actually was picked up on. The U.S. military thought this made a lot of sense.
So let me jump in here. Yeah. How does an oral surgeon get the attention of the president of the United States, who was behind this fully?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the crazy, this is happenstance and coincidence and everything else you want to roll together. He was also an inventor. And a man named Lytle Adams, he was out of Pennsylvania. And he had invented a system in the 1930s to use an airplane to capture mailbags from ships. Ships would, mail coming from Europe would come via ship, and it would take months and months and months. But if you could fly a plane out, meet the ship halfway or a little more than halfway, you could pick up the mailbag and then fly it back. This could decrease the time it takes for mail to come from Europe to the United States by a week or two. It's a great idea. And I got a patent for it, right? There's in the patent office, you can find Lytle Adams' patent for this process. And Eleanor Roosevelt heard about this. And Lytle Adams himself gave her a demonstration of this technology. He put her in his plane and flew her around and showed her how it worked. You can't imagine the Secret Service allowing Melania Trump today to get in some rando guy's private plane to fly around. But this was the 1930s. People weren't thinking that way. And so Eleanor loved the idea. Lytle Adams was described as basically a Santa Claus, a big, heavy-set, white-bearded guy, jolly laugh. He was just somebody that you just go, I like this guy. And so when he wrote a note to the White House, Franklin Roosevelt, my wife knows this guy. This, you know, this is at least worth looking into. And he passed it along to a man named William Donovan, who was at the time the director of the newly formed Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA.
Sometimes called Wild Bill.
Right, Wild Bill Donovan. And Wild Bill is his nickname from World War I. He was the most decorated soldier in American history, the only one to win all four of the top awards for being brave. And he was the head of this new organization. So he didn't really want to touch this. So he himself passed it along to a man named Vannevar Bush, who people don't know the name a whole lot, but he's incredibly important.
He's coming back now. People are learning about him. Yeah.
He was the head of what was called the OSRD, the Office of Scientific Research and Development during World War II. And this is the guy who's in charge of all science and research during the war, including the atomic bomb project, including radar technology, everything else we did. And he said, all right, let's see if this is viable. And so he kind of talked to some of his underlings and they said, you know what? This is a pretty good idea. We have new technologies like napalm, for instance, that had just been invented. We have the understanding of bats. Bat technology, quote unquote, had just been understood for the first time as far as they use echolocation. And, you know, all the stuff we learned in third grade had just been discovered in the 30s and 40s. And so the idea went to the U.S. Army and they put money behind it. And this is where we see a full field test of the Bat Project for the first time. And amazingly, it worked almost perfectly.
Almost is a major qualifier in this case.
Well, the proof of concept worked great. They built a out in the California desert, which is now Edwards Air Force Base. It was the Muroc dry test site at the time. They built a mock Japanese town with wooden and paper houses. And they brought the bats there and the bats burned it to the ground. Proof of concept worked perfectly. But you can't control bats as well as you can control anything else, including cats. Half the bats that were set to burn the Japanese village to the ground flew to a working U.S. Army airbase and burned that to the ground. So, yeah, it worked. It worked both times. One proof of concept was a little more costly for the U.S. government than the other. And adding insult to injury, the commander of the airbase was not told about this top secret program. And so he couldn't even get in with a fire crew to put out the fire of his hangars and guard towers and control towers and barracks as his army airbase burned to the ground.
So if not bomb-carrying bats, maybe glow-in-the-dark foxes?
Yes. So this is one of the most ridiculous plans, but you can understand why they were thinking this way. And this is also a World War II story, also focused on Japan, also the OSS. And this goes into the auspices of psychological operations, or PSYOPs, where Americans were constantly trying to find new and innovative ways to win wars easier. PSYOPs is often called a force multiplier. It makes your forces more powerful. And the big problem we were running into as we were doing the island hopping campaign, working our way towards the Japanese main islands, was that we would lose thousands and thousands of soldiers and Marines and airmen and sailors because the Japanese refused to surrender. They just fought to the last man. They did not, they were told by their government that the Americans would treat them as prisoners horribly, that they would be tortured, that they would be treated inhumanely. And there, many of them were fighting for the emperor anyway. So they were fighting to the death. Even the U.S. Marine couldn't scare them into surrendering. So the idea the OSS came up with is like, what if we can use a deep-seated suspicion that we thought they had? And this is a lot of American ethnocentrism here,
sure,
right? We're looking at them like, oh, they're kind of, they're Asians. They get spooked by things we wouldn't. Most Japanese were Shinto, and so they really wanted to embrace that religion and try to use it against the Japanese.
All right, hold that thought. We'll come back to the story in a minute. My guest is Vince Houghton. He's historian and curator at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and author of a new book called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. We'll be right back. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Vince Houghton. He's curator at the International Spy Museum, and he's got a new book out called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. So before the break, you were talking to us about what's called Project Fantasia, and you left us thinking about the fact that Americans at the time had a lot of really mistaken assumptions about the Japanese people in the 1940s.
That's a great euphemism, mistaken, ridiculous assumptions about the Japanese.
Ignorant.
Very chauvinistic, very ignorant, where they assumed that they were so backward and so primitive that their religion would take precedent over logic and over reason and everything else. And so most of the Japanese, yes, were Shinto. Shinto was the official religion of Japan. And within Shintoism, the fox has a special place. And in some cases, the fox can be a good omen. Most of the time, though, it's seen as either a mischievous or even an evil omen, where fox can be kind of like Loki, if you kind of look at the Norse
sort of equivalent. Trickster god.
Trickster yeah. god, or an absolute, you know, malevolent god, where it could take over bodies and cause them to do all sorts of possession. So this someone at OSS heard this idea and said, ooh, we can do something with this. So the concept was, let's get foxes. Let's spray paint the foxes with day glow, luminescent, glow-in-the-dark paint, and have them essentially be the vanguard of our forces. We would have them go first.
Into to these freak everybody out.
Right, to try to scare the Japanese soldier away. If the Marines can't do it, maybe a glow-in-the-dark fox can. And so they decided to test this concept. They didn't test it in Japan. They tested it in New York City in Central Park. And they released a bunch of glow-in-the-dark foxes, and it actually worked. There's a great article that that talks about this from the day later, where it's very 1940s speak. It says, you know, these glow-in-the-dark foxes ran around and gave everybody the screaming jimmies. I don't know what the screaming jimmies are, but apparently it scared everybody. And so it was just like, oh, we got something here. We got something here. So they brought it to Douglas MacArthur, who was the commander of all the Pacific forces, because he needed to know this new great plan the OSS had for helping to defeat the Japanese. And they're like, you know, General MacArthur, we've got these foxes. We're going to spray paint them glow-in-the-dark paint. And then they're going to go in ahead of your Marines and your soldiers to scare the Japanese away. And MacArthur said, well, how are you going to get them on the island? You're not going to parachute them onto the island, although that would be really cool if they were trying that. No, they were going to wade up like the Marines, do an amphibious landing. And MacArthur
got short little legs.
Well, but MacArthur's not necessarily a scientist, but he had the first, he's the first one we can find document wise to say, well, the glow in the dark paint's not waterproof glow in the dark paint. So if the foxes swim up, won't they just swim up as normal foxes that don't glow in the dark? And the OSS said, oh, whoops, maybe this isn't the great idea that we thought it was. And it turned out that that was the big problem. They didn't give up, though. They decided to keep on trying. Even if there's a little bit of glow-in-the-dark paint left over, maybe they could still be kind of scary. But it turned out that the atomic bomb solved the question altogether, and they never had to put this project into place. I mean, it would have taken several months to get fully combat ready, but they had to collect thousands and thousands of foxes. And that was the level they got to get permission to collect all these foxes. Finally, MacArthur's like, we don't need this. We've got another way to win the war. And so the amazing part about most of these stories is that they don't end because someone says they're a bad idea. They don't end because somebody says, no, we're not going to do this. That's not who we are. Most of the time they end because the war ends, or some other technology supersedes it, or some other event happens that makes it unnecessary. So you read this and you're like, or I was writing this and researching this thinking, it's wonderful that these programs never happened. But we really can't be all that optimistic because and there's a couple of exceptions, but not many. No one stopped this before it happened and right. said, no, this is a bad idea. It just was unnecessary at a certain point.
All right. Let's move off the terrible things we've done to animals in our name and talk a little bit about the Cold War. We considered all kinds of bizarre operations to cause the Cuban people to be disillusioned with Fidel Castro. What was Operation Good Times?
So there's a wonderful bevy of operations. The head of Cuban intelligence, I don't agree with this number, but argued that we tried to kill or get rid of Fidel Castro 638 times.
You think it's more or less?
I think it's way less, but the number's pretty high. All right, they're talking about hundreds of different options that we came up with to try to get rid of Fidel Castro. And some of them are fantastical. Like we talked about LSD, about MKUltra, one of these ideas was to lace his radio studio with LSD. So he gave a weekly radio address so that he would be high and tripping and seeing purple elephants when he gave his radio address. And the people would say, oh, this guy's gone crazy, and they won't follow him anymore. Another idea was to lace his shoes with thallium salts. And people may not know what that is. Essentially, it's nair. It's makes your hair fall out. And the idea was Fidel Castro's power comes from his beard. And if his beard falls out, the machismo of the Cuban people will force them to not want to follow Fidel anymore. And these go along with the ones people have heard about before, the exploding cigars, the laced cigars with botulism, the exploding seashells.
That was all considered for real.
Absolutely. And you can actually go online. What I tried to do in this book is to include at the back, not a footnoted reference, that's not that kind of book, but places where people could go and find out more information about this.
So why not just a bullet? Like, did we need to have plausible deniability?
Part of it was plausible deniability. Part of the bullet plan didn't work out all that well. One of the original plans was to enlist the help of the mafia. And that some of the planning was done in Las Vegas, where the mafia kind of moved to after they were kicked out of Havana. And these are the mobsters that everyone's heard of, right? The Lucky Luciano and Sam Giancana's and the ones that were the cream of the crop of the Cosa Nostra. And they were enlisted by CIA because they had a real dog in the fight when it came to Castro, because Havana was a money-making machine for them, to go and do the old-fashioned mobster hit shot in the back of the head hit. And they could never get close. Or if they did get close, they chickened out and decided not to do it. And that's kind of the air that Fidel had. Like the great story that I love more than any other one is the one of Maritza Lorenz, who was Fidel's girlfriend. He got her pregnant. He went off to do Fidel stuff, and she was drugged or something. We don't know for sure. And she woke up and the baby was gone. Either it was aborted or they stole it and they took it away. She was obviously very upset. She came to the United States and we recruited her to go back in and kill Fidel. So she goes back in with a gun. She meets up with Fidel. She's got the gun in her hand. He says, I know why you're here, but I can't be killed. I am Fidel. I am Cuba. And something in what he said or how he said it was so sensual that she said, you're right. She dropped the gun and they dove into bed together. And that's the kind of, you know, I don't even know how to, the air of something that Fidel had that made it very difficult for us to get to him. Not for lack of trying. And what I talk about in this book is that one of the simplest ways that we tried was to send somebody in with a sniper rifle to just take a straight shot and take out Fidel. And you'd think that would be easy, but it was so hard that it was attempted multiple times and then given up on because it was just too difficult logistically to get someone close enough to do it.
Okay, so we're sitting here in a studio in Washington, D.C., a place that is full of, embassies. The construction of a new Soviet embassy in the late 70s seemed like an ideal opportunity to just bug the place from top to bottom. Turned out to be a much more difficult operation than I would have imagined.
Well, I mean, there's a long history of bugging embassies, and this goes back decades. The Soviets were much better at it than we were. When we rebuilt our new embassy in Moscow, going back in the 60s and 70s, the Soviets were able to infiltrate it and essentially turn it into one big antenna. And we had to come in and knock the whole building down and rebuild it ourselves. We didn't have the same opportunity here because the Soviets, you know, they knew their own playbook. They were very aware of any kind of time we tried to do anything to what they were building as far as the infrastructure was concerned. But they couldn't really control what was happening underneath their embassy. And so the FBI and the NSA teamed up and planned something called Operation Monopoly. And the idea behind this was, let's acquire a house near the Soviet embassy, and we'll dig a tunnel from that house under the Soviet embassy and up into the Soviet embassy, which will allow us to tap into communications and listen into conference rooms and everything else inside the Soviet embassy. And they did. They built the tunnel. And for the most part, if it wasn't for an FBI mole, a man named Robert Hansen, who had been spying for the Soviets and later the Russians, he may have been able to pull this off. This wasn't a terrible idea, but it turned out to be problematic because the Soviets knew before a lot of us did that this was going on, because Hansen, as a highly placed FBI agent, was passing this information on to the Soviets as we were building this tunnel.
So I have to say the story that's been hardest for me to get out of my brain was actually dreamed up by the British. Why would anybody build an aircraft carrier out of ice?
So this is called Project Habakkuk, which made sense if you think about it. The idea, aircraft carriers are incredibly expensive to build. The ones in World War II were lightly armored, and they didn't have a lot of power. These aren't nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. So you could only launch lightly armored, lightly armed aircraft off of them, which didn't work very well when you brought those aircraft head-to-head with German land-based aircraft, which were heavily armored and heavily armed, which means that the British or the American planes didn't stand a chance. You need to build bigger aircraft carriers. But that was cost prohibitive. There's only so much steel. Steel has to go to building tanks, building airplanes, everything else. And you don't have the power to push around a massive aircraft carrier like we have today. The other issue is they're easy to sink. The Germans have wolf packs of submarines out there that want to see the juicy aircraft carrier and just, you know, start drooling like this is the perfect target. So how can you build a steelless aircraft carrier so you don't have to use your steel for other things, big enough that it can carry around large aircraft and up armored aircraft, and difficult, if not impossible, to sink? And a man named Jeffrey Pike, who was an inventor, he was a polymath, he was somebody who just kind of tinkered and everything, walked into the Admiralty office in the UK, to Lord Mountbatten, who was in charge of the war, basically, and said, "You need to hire me." Lord Mountbatten had no idea who he was, but he liked the moxie, right? And one of the ideas Pike had was for this aircraft carrier made of ice. Doesn't sink, as anyone who's had a soda with ice cubes in it knows, the concept of buoyancy. Easy to produce because it's water. Water's everywhere. And it doesn't take up any of your steel. So they tested this with standard ice, like brought down from the Arctic. And it turned out that it was very hard to trust ice because ice has different properties depending on, it's like snowflakes, right? Everyone Sure. is different. Ice cubes, everyone is different. The solution actually was a group of American researchers who discovered that if you mix in basically newspaper pulp, paper mache, with ice, it creates this compound that they called picrete, in honor of Jeffrey Pike, that was almost as hard as steel, that was uniform in its ability to withstand hits and everything else. So you didn't have to worry about one thing being less dense or less powerful than this. And it was pretty easy to produce. That allowed Pike to say, okay, let's build this thing. So they built the scale model of it in Canada, in Lake Up in Canada. You needed something remote. You needed something cold. You couldn't build it in Miami, right? You know, that's not, you're not going to build an iceberg aircraft carrier in Miami or in Dallas, right? So you go up to Canada, you build the scale model. And what they discovered was you could fire a cannon at it and it wouldn't even make a mark. You could crush it and actually had better tensile strength than steel. So it's great. The problem was it would cost so much to produce a single aircraft carrier that you would spend every resource on everything else to fight the war. So you could keep fighting the war and building ships and tanks and planes and men and everything else, or you could build one single iceberg aircraft carrier. And that became cost prohibitive for the British.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, what was the sun gun, and how did it go from being a potentially peaceful technology to something that was reconceived as like a Nazi super weapon?
Well, when you take something peaceful and you put it in front of the Nazis, it becomes a Nazi super weapon. I mean, I think that's that's a simple answer. This was an idea that will be familiar to most listeners if they've seen any of the Bond movies. This is kind of ripped out of a Bond movie, except it happened going back into the 1930s. And this is a concept that was going to be peaceful at first. You can understand the idea of a scientist thinking, if we could harness the power of the sun, then we would never have, you know, areas where famine happened because you'd always have direct sunlight. You could always grow new food. If you had massive floods and other things, you could burn off the water and get rid of the floodwaters much faster than you could otherwise. You could redirect sunlight to areas that were really cold and actually turn tundra into places where you could cook, you know, grow food and do other things. The Nazis took one look at this and said, well, if we can redirect sunlight, then we can do much, much more than just that. And this was a concept that went from simple and peaceful to absolutely dangerous. And What's interesting about it is these are some of the top Nazi scientists. One of them people have heard of, Wernher von Braun, who becomes the head of the German ballistic missile program, and then later on, in the American space program. And the Germans thought this was an idea that made sense. Now, this is one of those really long-term planning projects. The Germans weren't stupid enough to think they could build this by 1945, by the time the war ended. This was something that they understood was going to take decades. But this is a group that assumed that they had built a thousand-year Reich, and they had time to get this figured out. Not so fast. And that's the happy ending to the story, is that they never got the opportunity. But it didn't stop von Braun, when he became an American, from bringing up this idea again. To say, can we harness, and by harnessing the power of the sun, I'm talking about, this is Archimedes' principle. This is putting huge mirrors into space to redirect the beams of the sun. He thought this would be a perfect way to fight the Cold War, to essentially incinerate our enemies on the ground using the power of the sun. It turned out you would need a mirror the size of like 50 football fields in order to have a beam strong enough. This isn't like baking ants with a magnifying glass on the sidewalk. You would have to have an extraordinary amount of space and acreage to pull this off. And that became cost prohibitive. When you can just drop a nuke on somebody, you really don't need a gun that harnesses the power of the sun.
But it took them a couple of years to figure that out, right?
I mean, they did some testing. Both the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War were looking at this idea because it's the most basic idea, right? This goes back to Archimedes at Syracuse and burning the ships, which probably didn't happen, but whatever,
it's a good story, right?
It became good myth and everyone knew it. So no one was ignoring it and everyone understood that, you know, the sun is incredibly powerful. We should do something with it. But it did take some math and some science to figure out this was not something we could do.
I'm speaking this hour with historian Vince Houghton, curator at the International Spy Museum and author of Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Vince Houghton, who's curator at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and has just written a book called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. All right, we were talking about super weapons a moment ago, Vince. Scientists in the 50s were encouraged to think up maybe peaceful uses for nuclear technology. Jack Reed, though, was not a nuclear physicist.
Nope.
He was a meteorologist. What was his idea and how far did he get?
Yeah, I love Jack Reed. He's my spirit animal. I'm from Miami originally, and I've lived through at least 12 hurricanes. Hmm. I've lost count at a certain point. You know, as again, many of people in Eastern Texas can certainly understand that. And he was a witness to the Bikini test, so the nuclear test out in the Pacific. Basically, he was there to make sure that the fallout didn't blow and hurt anybody it was supposed to. But he witnessed the power of nuclear weapons and said, my God, this is something maybe we can use to help mankind, help us protect us against severe storms. In this case, he was thinking about hurricanes. And he had two ideas. One of them wasn't going to work. I mean, I don't like to say that a lot about these programs, because these aren't programs that failed. They never got a chance to fail. So I don't like to say whether they work or not. This one wasn't going to work. And the idea was to try to blow out the eye of a hurricane with a nuclear weapon. And the problem there is that nuclear weapons are not powerful. They're powerful enough, but they're powerful, but they're not powerful enough to do this to a hurricane. Hmm. An average hurricane has as much energy as tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. One is not going to do the trick. But Plan B had a better option. I think Plan B may have had an opportunity to do something. The idea was, anyone who's looked at the track of a hurricane realizes that most of them tend to go due west and then turn north at a certain point. Think of Hurricane Andrew, went through Miami and then turned north and hit New Orleans. Hurricane Katrina, same thing. Hurricane Sandy came right at the East Coast, turned north and hit the Northeast. That's that natural path. And it has a lot to do with the way the currents go up to eastern United States. Reed's idea was, what if I could turn the hurricane earlier so that it never hit land in the first place? So we could turn it north long before it got near the East Coast. And he thought, well, if I have a multi-megaton nuclear weapon, I detonate it on the outside of the hurricane, maybe I can disrupt the spin enough to make it turn north before it hits landfall. And this is a great idea. I really appreciate what Jack Reed was trying to do. The problem is, this is not something you can test in a laboratory. You can't replicate either a hurricane in a laboratory, and you can't replicate a nuclear explosion in a laboratory. So the only way you could test this was on a real live hurricane and detonating a multi-megaton nuclear weapon on the outside of a hurricane, which is great if it works. But if it doesn't work, then you have a 200-mile-an-hour radioactive storm heading for Miami, which the U.S. government was not willing to take that chance. And so Reed's ideas were left on the drawing board.
All right, let's get to the title of your book, Nuking the Moon. We wanted the world's attention. It's worth noting that one reason the Americans thought about detonating a nuclear weapon on the moon was that we actually thought the Soviets might do it first.
And they had we found out much later, through the declassification of some Soviet documents, that they had the same idea at the same time that we did, which just goes to show stupid ideas are not, you know, one nation versus the other. There's nothing patriotic about idiotic ideas. They happen everywhere. But one thing I try to do, and I emphasize this in the introduction, is I want people to ask those questions that's a knee-jerk. What were they thinking? That's the question you're going to ask when you're reading these stories. But just don't ask it that way. Instead, ask, what were they thinking? Can I put myself in the shoes of the people who are making these decisions at the time? Can I understand the fear they felt of this unknown world? Can I understand how threatened they felt from the Soviets or the Nazis or anybody else? It's hard to do in 2019 because we know the outcome. We know we won World War II. We know that the Cold War ended without, you know, World War III happening, which is unfair. Our hindsight provides us with an unfair advantage, not only unfair for the actors themselves at the time because we're judging them through a lens that they just did not have the information we do today, but it's unfair for us as historians, and anyone who studies history is a historian, right? So if we really want to understand how history happened and why it happened the way that it did, applying our 2020 hindsight to it doesn't do us any good. We have to, and I make lots of pop culture references in this book, and one of the ones that comes right off the beginning, we got to do what Master Yoda tells us to do. We have to unlearn what we have learned. We have to pretend we don't know the outcome. And in doing so, you can start to understand a little bit why people in 1958 were saying we should detonate a nuclear weapon on the moon, because they were terrified. The Soviets had just beaten us at our own game. Our game was science and technology. We were the true innovators of the world. Going back to the beginning of the 20th century, right? We invent the incandescent light bulb. We invent the atomic bomb, the airplane. We invent everything from chocolate chip cookies and microwave popcorn. We were the ones that everyone in the world looked to for science. And then all of a sudden, the Soviets beat us at our own game.
They put this little beach ball up into orbit.
It goes beep, beep. It doesn't do anything else, but it went up into space on top of a rocket that could be used as an ICBM for a nuclear weapon very soon thereafter. And number two, it was the diplomatic image of us being the true innovators that was destroyed. And in the Cold War, that meant everything. Because the developing world, Latin America, Africa, East Asia, was looking to the United States and the Soviet Union trying to figure out what side they wanted to join. That was what the Cold War was all about. And we always went to them and say, look, if you want to go from being the developing world to the developed world, come with us because we have the best scientists, we have the best innovators, we'll give you the best technology. That's how you get to become part of the first world. And the Soviets said, not so fast, right? We have the better scientists. So we need to do something immediately. We need to do something big to show that world that we were still the top kids on the block. And they decided to detonate a multi-megaton thermonuclear weapon on the moon was the solution to this problem.
How did the avuncular Carl Sagan get roped into all
this?
Yes,
billions and billions. So the guy who was given this project was a man named Leonard Riefel. And Riefel is a name that a lot of people don't know a whole lot about, but you've seen his work. We're about to have the 50th anniversary of the landing on the moon of Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin. Riefel became the deputy director of the Apollo program, so he's instrumental in putting men on the moon. He also was someone who was brought in to be a expert on the Chernobyl disaster. So anyone's watched the series lately, Chernobyl's been back in the conversation. He was somebody who came in to talk to them about how dealing with radioactivity. And then if you don't care anything about science or anything art and just watch football all the time or sports, he invented the telestrator, which is we see every single time we watch any kind of sporting event or the weather or anything else. He was a true polymath.
This is a little circle that's drawn around the action.
Yes.
Like a green
right.
Neon
so if
line.
You want to know what Spider 2 Y Banana is and the Cowboys running a certain play, John Madden can write it out for you and see. Or the weather pattern where the front is coming in to draw arrows. That's Rifle's invention. And at the time, he was had just finished a stint working for Enrico Fermi at the University of Chicago, so one of the original Manhattan Project scientists. This is a guy who was one of the greatest scientists of the 20th century. We just don't know anything about him. Air Force tapped him, and they said, okay, we want to talk about this project of a nuclear weapon on the moon. He realized he didn't know a whole lot about it, certainly about the geology side of things. So he brought in a guy named Gerard Kuiper. And Kuiper is a name that might also ring a bell. There's something called the Kuiper Belt on the very outskirts of the solar system outside of Neptune. It's tens of thousands of icy bodies, comets, other things. And Kuiper brought a young grad student with him to do math. And you know, professors at that level don't do a lot of their own math. They bring someone along. And Carl Sagan was that guy because he was the mathematician working on his PhD to figure out essentially what it would look like if a nuclear explosion happened on the moon.
What would it look like?
It would be boring. It wouldn't look like a, you know, I use the word gorgeous mushroom cloud. I understand I'm talking about nuclear weapons.
There, it is a compelling thing to see.
Yes, it is a iconic, stereotypical view of what a nuclear weapon looks like when it goes off, that mushroom cloud. That's what they wanted to create. The Air Force is like a mushroom cloud on the moon. Well, mushroom clouds exist when you have a dense atmosphere. There's no atmosphere to speak of at all on the moon. It's a vacuum. So most of it would look like is just a bunch of dust flying in a lot of different directions. You'd probably, under the perfect conditions from the Earth, see a bright light and then dust. That really wasn't what the Air Force was looking for. But that's probably not why they canceled this program. There's no real smoking gun about why they canceled this program. My theory, and growing up, the movie The Right Stuff was one of my favorite movies of all time. I read the book multiple times. And if you remember, there's a scene in The Right Stuff. It's a montage of rockets blowing up and rockets flying 30 feet up in the air and flipping around and coming back down. That's 1960, 1961, before we actually get Alan Shepard into space. Well, in 1958, we were even less confident that we could launch a rocket with a multi-megaton thermonuclear weapon into space and not have it turn around and come back down and take out Fort Lauderdale or Atlanta or Cape Canaveral. So the worry of trying to do this was probably what superseded our need to blow up the moon or put a big part of the moon. And then at the same time, of course, is when the Apollo program was, NASA was really pushing for this. Like, forget blowing up the moon, let's put people on it. And that superseded the need to do this.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Since we're on the Cold War, I want to talk about Project Washtub. This was this like contingency plan to have sabotage forces in place if the Soviets took Alaska, right? Talk a little bit about who they were trying to recruit for this.
Well, it's funny. This almost doesn't belong in the book. I kind of stretched the definition because this actually program actually went into place. Like actually, the program happened. So what they were basically doing is recruiting backwoods Alaskan survivalists. These are the people who lived in cabins without electricity. These are people who could live off the land, you know, eat a squirrel for breakfast, and had knowledge of all the different areas around backwoods Alaska. We're not talking about Juneau here. We're not talking about metropolitan. There's really no, you know, this is not Nome. This is the middle of nowhere, Alaska. And the idea was if there was a Red Dawn scenario in Alaska and World War III broke out and the Soviets invaded across the Bering Sea, into Alaska, could we do something about it? Because the U.S. military was not prepared to kind of push back anything. So the idea was we would create a cadre of what we call left behinds or stay behinds. These are people who would, during the initial invasion, would kind of dissolve into the countryside, live off the land, lay low. When the Soviets consolidated their strength, when they got complacent, they would pop back up and conduct sabotage operations and paramilitary operations. They would recruit people to spy on the Soviets, and they would make their lives a living hell. And they actually put this program into effect for several years. Many Alaskans went through a training program that basically was a mini version of what CIA operations officers get at the farm down in Virginia. And the cast of characters, I look at it as there's a show called Northern Exposure in the 90s. It's Northern Exposure hybrid with Red Dawn. And to me, I was imagining these guys in my head, and it was just a wonderful picture of how diverse America is and how different they were than I was. Right, you give me 10 minutes in the middle of Alaska somewhere, and I'd be like, I surrender.
Yeah,
right. I surrender.
But they didn't take Native Alaskans, like Inuit peoples.
No women and no Native Americans. Because the Native Americans, it was straight discrimination. They drank too much. They didn't really. You don't want the people that actually know the land.
That was
better
the perception.
Right, that was the perception, right? That was, this is 1950s America, right?
Yeah.
So, they're Natives. All they do is get drunk. It shows that our discrimination, and this goes back to McCarthyism and other things, gets in the way of national security. Because who better knows that territory than the people who have been living up there for generations and generations and generations? And they didn't take women because I don't know why. 1950s America, because of some, you know, patriarchal chauvinism saying like women can't hack it. Well,
like you can't fight the Soviets in pearls and heels.
Right. I mean, even though in World War II, women had consistently demonstrated that they were as good as men doing covert operations in espionage. The minute that war ended, all of a sudden people forgot how effective women were during that war.
So, Vince, I really enjoyed reading all these stories, but I can't help but wonder, like, what are we wasting money on right now?
I hope a lot. I'm being dead. It's the job of intelligence agencies and part of the military to think way, way, way outside the box. These are hard problems to solve, and we have a lot of hard problems to solve today. And if they were easy to solve, the diplomats would do them, the politicians would take care of them. It wouldn't be something that eventually found its way down to an intelligence agency. There needs to be people that are willing to fail. And I think that's what makes, I'm not trying to rah-rah United States here, but what makes this book really focus on the British and the Americans is because these are two civilizations, two societies that didn't punish their scientists for failing and falling flat on their faces. And if you want to be truly innovative, you got to take chances that you're going to make a huge mistake and you're going to waste a lot of money and not worry that you're going to get put up against the wall, you know, or put in the gulag. And so I'm hoping today, especially because our adversaries are getting more and more creative in the way that they're going to come after us. When the greatest superpower in the world, you're not going to put an army on the field against us. You're going to find creative ways. So we have to think of creative ways to come up with innovations that can, if we're not going to use them ourselves, so that we're not surprised by somebody else. And that's where I hope there are people that are thinking. I try not to be derogatory about these guys who came up with these ideas, because I think today we're in the same boat in many respects.
Vince Houghton is historian and curator at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. His new book is called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince, thanks so much for spending this hour with
us. I really appreciate you having me.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think, and we hope that you'll sign up for the Think podcast using your favorite podcast app. You can also listen to the show and find out what we have planned for upcoming programs at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.